This is Grow in Grace, a daily teaching ministry of Palmetto Baptist Church in Greenville, South Carolina. What do you do when you're faced with a challenge? Very early in Jesus' life, Joseph, his adopted father, was warned of an oncoming danger, and he responded in faith, trusting God's messenger. Today, we'll conclude a sermon titled, Kingdoms in Conflict. Let's listen together so we can grow in grace.
Herod may have been sitting in his Herodium. Some of you have been over to the Herodium. Beautiful, stunning tomb of Herod during the time of Herod's life was a palace, a military fortress, and it's only 4 miles from the events that we're reading about. And the angel of the Lord shows up and he says, I want you to know that the most powerful man in your world, he has all the resources. He is Herod the Great. He's a great builder. He's a great architect. He's a great political and savvy political leader. He is ruthless in his opposition to anybody who's going to come anywhere near touching his kingdom. Ask his wife. Ask his sons, who he strangled toward the end of his life to hold on to that little throne that Rome had given him. And he has decided that he is going to do whatever he has to do, including murdering all the babies of the village, to make sure he is not unseated from his throne. And the angel comes with urgency and intensity to reveal the malicious intent of Herod to obliterate the child. What hope did a little carpenter from Nazareth have in the face of all of this? You ever feel that way? I mean, what hope do we really have as followers of that king? What hope do we have? Think about our resources. I mean, here we are, we're in a rented facility. I mean, what hope do we have if the forces of evil were to actually zero in on us? What hope do we have? You might feel that personally. What hope do I have? How in the world am I going to survive when this is coming against me and that is coming against me and these people are opposing me? What hope do I have? And what you notice in this section is there is an immediate protection that comes from God's revelation to this man. God says to Joseph, I know something. Herod is going to send soldiers to murder that baby, but I'm going to send my own soldier. I'm going to send one of my angels from one of my armies, and he is going to warn you. He is going to give you the way out. And you can see it in the text, right? Look at verse 13. Behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. This is the second time, or the third time rather, the second time that Joseph receives a dream. There's a third time coming at the end of the chapter, and he gets warned, and there is a way of escape. The angel has a solution. God has a solution. Joseph, I want you to take Mary and the child, and I want you to go down to Egypt. This is the third time in the history of the nation of Israel that God has sent his people to Egypt for protection. It happened in the days of Abraham and Isaac. It happened again in the days of Joseph, and now it is happening here. And God is saying, I want you to take Mary and her child, and I want you to go down to Egypt. Now, this protection that came through divine revelation was acted upon through the obedience of a devoted servant. I mean, think about Joseph. His whole life in this narrative is constantly being disrupted. It's constantly being interrupted. It's in constant turmoil. I was going to get married. I had the woman of my dreams. We were going to have a little house. I've got this job I've been working on, and we're going to have a baby, and it's going to be great. And his whole world blows up when Mary shows up pregnant. And God appears to him in a dream, and now he's here in Bethlehem, and the baby has arrived, and the magi have come, and again, his world is blowing up. And here's what's interesting. Every time God blows up Joseph's world, Joseph responds in obedience. Every time. Every time. I've got these plans. I want to go here. I want to do this. I'm a just man. I want to serve the Lord. And God says, that's not what I want you to do. And every time, three times in the text, when Joseph gets this from the Lord, here's what it says, and Joseph did what the Lord said. He was compliant. He was obedient to the word of God. He was obedient to the Spirit of God. You know, sometimes you and I have big plans about what we're going to do for the Lord. I'm going to go do this. I'm going to go here. This is how I've got it all planned out. And God sometimes comes along and says, that's not what I want you to do. I want you to stay right here, or I want you to go over there, and I want you to do this. And it's hard. We sort of resist that. Or maybe it's the other way. Maybe God says, I want you to go here, or I want you to go there. And it's hard because it disrupts our carefully laid plans, things we're excited about, our hopes, all of that. And here's Joseph. And three times in this narrative, Joseph's life is upended for the sake of Jesus. And he obeys. I wish I were more like Joseph. I think probably if you're honest and you looked at your own life, you wished you were more like Joseph. And all of this is to get Jesus down to Egypt because there's an important theological reason that is going on, and Joseph doesn't know it. I mean, here's the thing that's so amazing to me about Joseph. He gets information from God, but he never gets the whole picture. And he still obeys. We're like, Joseph, you have no idea what's going to happen. This is going to be awesome. But Joseph says, all I know is this angel came, and he told me to get down to Bethlehem. He told me to marry Mary, and now he's telling me to go to Egypt. And so off he goes. 75 miles down to Egypt's borders. There are about a million people, a million Jews living in Egypt at that time. And so for the next year or so, Joseph and Mary and Jesus are safely ensconced in Egypt. So what is God doing? Why all of this? And the answer is this. It's what Matthew pointed to. It's that all that Hosea said would be fulfilled. And what did Hosea say? That out of Egypt, I have called my son. So what in the world is going on there? If you go back to the book of Hosea, that text is talking about a time in Israel's history when a group of people are going to be carried off into captivity, and God wants you to know who they are. These people who the Assyrians are about to take off into captivity and destroy everything that they have and bring them into brutal subjection, these people are God's children. God says, these people are my son. This is my son, Ephraim. Ephraim was, in the history of Israel's people, one of Joseph's sons, and he came to represent the northern tribes. And here are people who belong to God who are being carried off into captivity and brutalized, and God wants the world to know who they are. These people are my son. There's only one other time where God identifies the nation of Israel in those terms, and you have to go all the way back to Moses in Exodus chapter 4 to find it. And in Exodus chapter 4, God says to Moses, I want you to go and tell Pharaoh a message. And here's the message. When you get there, I want you to tell Pharaoh to let my firstborn son, Israel, go so they could come and worship me. You say, Pastor, I hear you. I get the son bit. But what's going on with the son, this son language? And the answer is this, that there is another son. Israel was the son of God in the Old Testament, not the second member son of God, not the second member of the Trinity relational sonship that we have with Jesus. But as Jesus identified this nation to the world, he wanted the world to know, this nation is my son. It is my firstborn. In the next chapter, Matthew is going to take us to the baptism of Jesus. And at the end of that baptism, God is going to speak from heaven to the world. And he's going to say, this one is my what? My son, my beloved son. And so what you have here is a massive identity being revealed to you that this Jesus who is being taken down to Egypt for safety, just like Abraham and Isaac and Joseph, is actually the son that is going to accomplish everything that the first son was supposed to accomplish and didn't. God had a mission for this son. God had a mission for Israel. God had a purpose for Israel. And the reason they're going into captivity in Hosea 11 is because they blew it repeatedly. They couldn't accomplish the mission. They couldn't love God with all their heart and all their soul and all their mind. They couldn't keep the law. They couldn't live faithfully. And they certainly couldn't bear God's name to the nations. And God sent prophet after prophet after prophet. And by the time you get to Jeremiah, this nation is gone. And God says, I'm not done with that nation. In fact, I'm going to raise that nation up, and I'm going to give it a powerful representative. I'm going to embody that nation in a person, and that person is going to do everything that nation could not do. This person is going to fulfill the law perfectly. This person is going to love me with all of his heart and with all of his soul and with all of his strength. And he is going to fulfill all the mission that I gave to that person. And his name is Jesus. And to make sure you don't miss this identification, Jesus as the new Israel, I'm going to send him down to Egypt. And I'm going to call him out of Egypt just like I called my firstborn son in the Old Testament, the nation of Israel. This is a stunning identification. Well, why does he have to go to Egypt? And the answer to that is obvious. This is where the cymbal player starts banging away. The answer to that is that the kingdom of darkness is going to oppose this new and better Israel who's been embodied in the person of Jesus. And to help us understand how to respond to that, and how to sort of make sense of the symbol that's just clanging away around us, Matthew says, let me give you the second part of this little section we're in. There is divine comfort in the midst of ruthless persecution. And you can see that in verses 16 through 18. And we've already kind of pointed to the fact that Herod does an atrocity here. He slaughters a whole village of infants, 2 years old and under. Now, I want you to stop and think about this for a minute. This is not the first time this has happened, is it? Can you think of another political ruler, cruel, tyrannical, malicious, who murdered 2-year-old infants? Herod was doing it to destroy Jesus and to stop the kingdom that he represented. But in the Old Testament, there is a Pharaoh who is going to destroy all the babies who are born in Israel. And he doesn't know why yet. But really what's going on is there is an attempt to keep Moses out of the picture. So all of a sudden, you've got a king in the New Testament and a king in the Old Testament, and they're doing the same thing. There is this atrocity that is happening. They are two in a long line of antichrists who are going to stand against the leader that God is going to raise up to deliver the world. And behind them, in Revelation 12, is an even greater antichrist, a satanic opponent named Satan. He's described as a devil, a dragon, and in Revelation 12, he is watching for the birth of a child so that he can devour the child. And that child is going to be born of a woman that has 12 stars on her head, and you know immediately that this is the nation of Israel. And so, in all of this, Matthew says, now as you think about that, as you think about Herod and Pharaoh and the dragon and what they're doing to oppose this new Moses, I want you to remember something. I want you to go back to Jeremiah 31, and I want you to remember that Jeremiah gave instruction to a woman who was weeping. And that woman had been dead for 1,000 years. She was the mother of the nation, and she was weeping in Jeremiah 31 because her children were being held in a little town called Ramah on their way to the Babylonian captivity. And if you read Jeremiah 31, the next thing that Jeremiah says to the woman is, dry your tears. Stop weeping. These sons that are being carried off into captivity, they're all going to come back. These sons whose heart is so hard and they reject and disobey me, their heart is going to be softened. Their heart is going to be turned to me. There is hope for your labor. There is a future for you. There will be mercy. There will be rest. And this is going to come, Jeremiah says, when somebody greater than Moses arises and he brings to you a covenant that is new. There is a new covenant. Jeremiah 31 is right in the middle of a section in the book of Jeremiah called the Book of Consolation or the Book of Comfort. And it's like Matthew says, as you read about the slaughter of these infants, I want you to remember that this isn't new. This has always been how the dragon has worked to destroy the sun. It happened in Moses' day. It happened in Pharaoh, with Pharaoh and Moses, and now it's happening with Herod and the baby. But God is saying to all of you who are weeping in the midst of all of this anguish, dry your tears. The one who is going down to Egypt is going to come back, and he's going to bring a new covenant with him. He's going to bring a new hope with him. He's going to give you a better righteousness, and he's going to establish a better kingdom. Wow. No wonder the cymbal player's going nuts. If I'm Herod or I'm Pharaoh, that's the last thing I want. And if I'm somebody who's looking at Jesus and realizing Jesus has the right to rule my life, that's the last thing I want. And sometimes the opposition is fierce and sometimes the opposition is harsh. But in the midst of all of that, there is comfort. In the midst of all this opposition, there is not just a new Israel, there is a new Moses. And this Moses, when he arrives, is going to bring a new covenant with him and a new righteousness and a new strength and a new mercy and a new rest. But as we close out this morning, all of this is living down in Egypt. So for the next however many months, Joseph and Mary and this little baby, this new Moses, who's the embodiment of Israel, are secreted away down in Egypt. And back in Jerusalem, nothing has changed except one thing. Herod died. But nothing changed. His son, Archelaus, comes to the throne. He's as radical and as cruel and as tyrannical as his father. He's just not as politically savvy. And the angel of the Lord comes to Joseph and he says, Joseph, it's time to go back. And Joseph's like, well, okay, I'll pack up and we'll head back to Bethlehem. But now God has to get Messiah all the way back up to Nazareth for a theological reason. And the reason is so that he would be called a Nazarene. That's an interesting thing because you can look through the entire Old Testament prophetic literature and you will never, ever find a prophecy where somebody says Jesus will be called a Nazarene. And there are two things I want you to think about as we close. One of them is this. When you called somebody a Nazarene in Jesus' day, it wasn't a compliment. Nazareth was this little tiny village up in the northern part where all the Gentiles, all the unclean Gentiles lived, in Galilee of the Gentiles, and right in the middle of that was this tiny little village of nobodies called Nazareth. It would be like you saying the Messiah is going to be a hick from the sticks, and nobody would ever have imagined that. That's why Nathanael in John 1, when he's told, hey, we found the Messiah, he's Jesus and he's from Nazareth, first thing out of his mouth is, what? How can anything good come out of Nazareth? Remember that? On top of the cross, remember when Pilate wrote the wording across the top of the cross? Jesus of what? Nazareth. In Acts 24, the followers of Jesus were scorned as the sect of the Nazarene. This was a derision, sort of a mockingness. What did Isaiah 53 say? He was what? Despised and rejected. But there's something else besides the derision and the rejection. In Isaiah chapter 11, we read about a branch that is going to come out of the tree that God cut down. David's tree was cut down, but it didn't die. There's a branch that's going to come out of that tree, and that branch is going to have a ton of fruit. It's going to bear a lot of fruit. You know what the word branch in Hebrew is? It's the word that we get the word Nazareth from. You know, if you were sort of looking at the word Nazareth and you were sort of saying, well, what does that word mean? It means branch. You could say, this is Branch Town, or this is Branchville. And if you lived in Nazareth and you came from Nazareth, you were a Branchvillian. Just like you're a Greenvillian or whatever, you're a Branchvillian. Here is a branch coming from Branch Town. And Isaiah 11 says there is a branch that is going to come out of David's house, and he is going to bear fruit. And you read the rest of Matthew, and there first are 12, and then there are 120, and then there are 500 followers of the Lamb who've been taken out of the kingdom of the world and put into the kingdom of his dear son. And then there are more than 500 who see him at one time. And then you start reading through the rest of your New Testament, and there are tens of thousands of people who are the fruit of this branch all through the Roman Empire. And down to our day, there are hundreds of millions of us all over the world. This branch, this kingdom, has borne fruit. And there is more fruit to come. So what do I do? Can I give you four things to do? And we'll pray. If you're a part of this kingdom, understand you are in the kingdom of the world, but you're there for a reason. If you're part of this kingdom that this baby came to start, seek that kingdom fervently. Serve his purposes faithfully in the kingdoms of the world. I mean, we're here because we're part of a glorious kingdom, and we're supposed to be reaching the people in the kingdom of the world. And that's the advances gospel personally part. Enjoy his presence passionately. You know, when you think about what Matthew's doing, he is announcing the invasion of a kingdom by another kingdom. He's announcing the fact that the kingdoms of the world have been invaded by a king who is going to bring with him a kingdom. And in Revelation 11, here's what you see at the end of the story. The kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of the Son. And all of heaven celebrates that. You and I are part of that kingdom. We don't see the physical kingdom here yet. That's coming. But we're part of that kingdom. And Matthew has set it up for us. We now know what to expect. We know how to handle what's coming our way. And we know what to do as we align ourselves with the King. And we serve his purposes and advance his gospel in the kingdoms of the world where we're at.
Thank you, Pastor Sam. Today's speaker, Dr. Sam Horn, is the pastor for preaching and vision at Palmetto Baptist Church. PBC meets at 2730 Anderson Road, Greenville, South Carolina. Come join us for our morning worship service every Sunday at 9:30 a.m. Or you can find us online at pbcpowdersville.org. Grow in Grace is recorded by the audio team at PBC and produced by CJ Billieux. Join us again next time so together we can grow in grace.